fish number 10430, reel 2.
Did you Gadsden, reel 2?
He came in only a day or so after the road had been opened over the Mayu Range, and there had been a Jap detachment up on the top. So he spoke to the British officers. The troops all stood too in their trenches.
What happened to you next?
Well, by then, of course, we were a bit decimated. We hadn't really lost a lot of people in my unit, but some of the others were pretty badly shot up. So we were pulled back into reserve. And it was then realised the whole strategy of the war in Burma on behalf of the Japanese was to hit in the Arakan and make a feint, in fact. And the feint was on the left in the Arakan, but the punch came in on the Imphal plain, away to the north, on the right. And it was realised as we went into reserve that there was a tremendous Japanese attack building up on the Imphal plain, and even extending as far as Kohima, which is farther north still in the Naga Hills. And from reserve, we were very quickly put into ships and river boats and ferried up the Brahmaputra to Dimapur, which was the main Indian base on the Assam plain for the whole of the army in Imphal, because there's only one road to get from India into Burma in that particular area, and that's Dimapur, Kohima, Imphal, which is a distance, I suppose, of 150, 200 miles, something like that. And as we were ferrying up the Brahmaputra, the Japanese attacked Kohima, and once again the troops went into a very tight little box and they were forced back and back in Kohima. And it was again hand-to-hand fighting, and in fact there's the famous tennis court which I've seen there in the bungalow in the middle of Kohima, where the Japanese were on one side of the tennis court and the British troops were in trenches on the other. And that was a situation that lasted for, a fortnight or more. And it was desperate hand-to-hand fighting all the time. And if the Japanese had only, what should we say, disobeyed their orders, which were to capture Kohima, and swung round the side and had a go at Dimapur, the whole outcome of the war would be slightly different, because Dimapur had no defences and was wide open to the Japanese, and the amount of equipment there covered square miles of countryside, ammunition, rations, everything that an army needs was all building up at Dimapur. And it could have been captured by the Japanese because it had no real defences. It was quite open. But the Jap is told, go and capture Kohima. And that's what he does. We'd seen this in the Arakan, where we'd captured an operation order which says troops will rendezvous at the corner of Chong, and gave a map reference, the corner of this Nulla stream known as a Chong in the Arakan. And so at night the Japanese arrived at this corner of the Chong, and our troops were there ready to ambush them with hand grenades and machine guns, and they killed a lot on the first night. And they went back and laid the ambush again, and the same thing happened. And this happened four or five nights running, because the Japanese would never alter any orders that they got. And this is what happened at Kohima. They were told to capture Kohima, and they fought until they died to try and capture Kohima. as they were doing it, we were building up on the road between Dimapur and Kohima. And I moved in with the 4th 14th Punjab Regiment and took over the Naga village just as Kohima was being relieved. There was a tank standing on the top of the road firing as we moved in, and I had a good friend there too, who was the adjutant of the 4th 15th Punjab Regiment, and he said to me, "Come on, Peter, you run across here, there's a sniper that fires." And he upped and ran, and his orderly ran, I noticed, fairly smartly, and when I tried to run, this sniper fired at me and put a bullet absolutely past my head, and you can always tell a bullet that's near, of course, because it goes, whereas a bullet which is passing a reasonable distance overhead or something, all you hear is and it just whistles away into the distance. But if you hear one tack as it goes by, you know jolly well you've stood pretty close to it. And this chap put one very close to me, and so I fell on the ground, got another one in the hill just below me, and another one over my back. So I scuttled into the other trench as fast as I could jolly well go. And we stayed in the Naga village for about a week, in contact with the Japanese. But then we found our patrols going out at night were finding that they were withdrawing, they were disappearing from various places. And the next job was to follow them up and cut the road between Kohima and Imphal, with the idea of cutting the road and getting behind them and catching the lot who'd been in Kohima in a pretty poor state, and hopefully destroying them. It was tough because it was starting monsoon. It was impossible country. The mountains were between 5,000 and 7,000 feet and dropped straight down into rivers at the bottom, right in the mountains between India and Burma. Thick jungle and mud such as you've never seen. We tried using jeeps, but jeeps just became bogged down in it. You couldn't get jeeps over it. So in the end, it was men and mules. We had to carry everything that we wanted, either had to go on the man or on the back of a mule. And we advanced along a knife-edge ridge, and I still remember Kidima, Kazoma, Okrafoku, and Mao Songsang. Those were the villages along, and Mao Songsang was the objective, and it was the village on the Kohima Imphal Road that we had to capture to cut the Japs off. And when we got to Kazoma, the colonel sent for me and he said, "Gadsden, the battalion in front's held up in front of Kazoma. I want you to lay an ambush at the back of the village, and I will attack at dawn, and you will act as long stop." And I thought it was a little ambitious, really, because we were the other side of the village on a knife-edge ridge. And I had the job of getting to behind the village during the night so as to be ambushed to catch the Japanese running away in the morning. So it only seemed to me, I was told this about tea time in the afternoon, only seemed to me to be one way of setting about this, and that was to drop down the side of the mountain and go along the side, come up behind the village and settle on the top, which sounds quite simple. But I started taking my company, 120 men, in single file, cutting away through the jungle. And we found the first thing that happened was that there was a stream running down the side of the mountain, and it went round the corner and right into the stream, and then you forded the stream, which was tumbling down a sort of continuous waterfall, crossed over that and out the other side, in the big crease it had cut in the mountain. And I'd been cutting jungle for about 3 hours, and I looked over my shoulder, and the rest of the company were only 50 yards away across the gap, so we hadn't made any distance in 3 hours. We'd cut our way right into the stream and right the way out again. So I sent for my Subedar, the Viceroy's commissioned officer, and said, "Now then, Subedar, what are we going to do?" And he said, "Sahib, all we can do is go down into the river and go along the river." And that's exactly what we did. We scrambled down this waterfall thing into the river at the bottom, 5,000 feet down. Well, it wasn't 5,000 feet because it wasn't down to sea level, of course. It was down from the mountain to the level of the river. And we scrambled up the river, me trying to read the map, until we came to a fork in the river, which I could see was at the back of the village. And I well remember that in doing this, we had to walk right through a gorge, struggling along through the various pools in the river. And I thought to myself, you know, this time you have had it, because if there's just one Japanese with a box of hand grenades up on top of this gorge, he's only just got to throw them over the side and you're all dead. So we came to the far end that split in the river, and that was the place which I was saying earlier. Sikhs actually carried me up the side of the hill, and we sat all night on the top, and of course I'd fallen in the river and got my clothes wet. And so it wasn't a very happy night at 5,000 feet in damp clothes. And fortunately, I remember that Waris Khan, my orderly, had managed to bring a little rum with him, and we sat taking sips of rum all night until dawn, when the colonel came through with the troops. And as usual, the Japs had withdrawn during the night, so I was just lucky. I was always lucky in that way. And we pushed on to Mao Song Sang. We cut the road to Imphal, but we were just behind the Japanese who'd withdrawn on down the road. But they were in a very desperate state. We captured two prisoners, very badly wounded there, two Japanese, who were absolutely covered in flies, those big blue blowflies. They'd had their legs damaged, and I remember those, the Japanese prisoners were in a very bad state. So was I, because I'd got an upset tummy. And really was down to, I suppose, 7 or 8 stone, something like that.
What had caused the upset?
This really is part of the story. That the water that one drinks, of course, causes the upset. And we had a new colonel arrived, and he took one look at me and said, "Hospital in Kohima." And off I went to hospital in Kohima. And there was a chap in the bed beside me who'd got malaria, which is, of course, the thing that really decimated the army. A lot of people went down with malaria. But if you took your Mepocrine pills daily, you went a strange yellow colour. But I worked right the way through and down the Khabur Valley, which is one of the most malarial in the world, and going back into Burma. And in all the years I was out there, I never did get malaria. But I went into hospital at Kohima.
When was this? About?
Now we're talking about 44, about August 44. Yes, August 44. And I went back into Kohima and saw this chap beside me in bed with malaria. And another chap, the other side, who'd got an upset stomach as well, dysentery in all probability. And obviously they thought I had dysentery. I just couldn't hold anything down. And along came the doctor and said, yes, well, we'll do some tests. You're on an egg and milk diet. And so I thought, well, that's nice. So I lay on my bed, and the orderly came round, a British orderly, and said, do you want a cup of char and a wad? And I said, a cup of char and a wad? I'm on an egg and milk diet. And he said, yes. He said, there isn't any milk and the eggs haven't come up. So would you like a cup of char and a wad? So, which in army parlance you may know is a cup of tea and a cake. So I said, oh, all right. So I had a cup of tea and a cake. 2 days later, they came along and they looked at the chap beside me and said, yes, you've got malaria. Well, there weren't any mosquito nets or anything. And I thought, well, I don't know. He's got malaria and the mosquitoes about here. And they looked at the chap. They looked at me and said, we're not sure about you. We're going to do some more tests. And they looked at the chap the other side of me and said, yes, you've got dysentery. You're going back to base hospital. And so they walked out of the ward. And I got out of bed and put my clothes on. And along came the orderly and said, what are you doing? So I said, I'm going back to the battalion. I said, he's got malaria. He's got dysentery. I haven't got anything. But I damn soon will have if I stay here much longer. So I got out of bed and I said, now, look, don't interfere with me because I'm going back to my unit. And I stopped a truck on the road, went back to the unit, and went and saw old Dr. Dutt, Captain Dutt, our little Bengali doctor, and he gave me 120 pills of sulfur guanidine, which was used in those days for upset tums. And I used to take these jolly great pills every 4 hours, and very soon I was as right as rain. And in fact, the colonel said, you know, what a marvellous thing that a chap should want to come back to the battalion that much, and he put me in for a decoration. And it wasn't that at all. It was, in fact, that I was just scared of catching something in the hospital. So at any rate, I went back to the battalion, and I was very soon cured, no problem.
Did you get the decoration?
Yes, I got the MBE, in fact. Yes.
Did the Indian troops suffer as much from the conditions as the British officers?
Oh, no, because, of course, no. If you're brought up in a village, I'm no medical man, but I'm given to understand that what happens is that you develop antibodies in the blood and in the gut, which kill the bacteria, which cause the British people real problems. And if you acclimatise in India for many years, you gradually get inured to these sort of things, and you no longer get the same stomach upsets if you've been there for a good number of years. Oh, it's a matter of being a native of the country.
So once you joined the unit, were they in action, or had they been pulled out?
They'd been pulled out at Mao Song Sang. We were pulled out because we were very badly we were just skeletons. We didn't have so many casualties. We had a few casualties, but we were all skeletons, with being on half rations and having stomach upsets and all that sort of thing. So we were pulled out and put into Kohima. That would be September time. And we stayed in Kohima, taking in reinforcements, until the middle of December. And that was the year in which Mountbatten said, we will fight through the monsoon. And we did. We fought through the monsoon, and we kept on right the way through until December. And then by December time, we began to move forward again, and we moved into Imphal, and then from Imphal down to Tarmu, from Tarmu into the Kabul Valley.
What was Imphal like after the fighting there?
Well, it's a very big plain with a big lake in the middle of Imphal, surrounded by mountains, And where the battles took place, at places like Potsdam Bang, where there was desperate fighting with the Gurkhas and various VCs won and so on, in places like Potsdam Bang, it was just a sea of mud and everything was eliminated due to the shelling and all the rest of it. But that was fairly local, and the Imphal plain itself is a pretty big size, and a lot of the battling was done to gain the heights above the plain so as to overlook the main dumps and the airstrip and so on. And it's not a... it's not a plain that you can just see across. It's some good many miles long. So, yes, I remember passing through various places, moving down the road from Imphal to Tamu, where there'd been terrific battles, and all the hillsides were absolutely shaved of jungle, where the guns had been firing, bombs had been dropped on Japanese positions. And then, of course, our role was to swing left at Tamu to the north and come round towards the back of Mandalay and push the Japanese back towards Mandalay. But what in fact happened was that the Japanese withdrew very quickly from all the northern area there. And this was where Bill Slim, General Slim's crossing of the Irrawaddy and attack on Mike Tiller was suddenly brought in to get behind the Japanese army at Mandalay. And so we were switched. At Tamu, we went a short way to the left, and within a matter of a week or so, the Japanese withdrew. We were switched right round the whole front, hundreds of miles, to the right, and we went right down the Kabul Valley to where the Chinwin River joins the Irrawaddy. And we came in at a place called Pakoku. And there was a small battle before that at a place called Tilin, where we were switched because there was a Japanese unit down there, not very large, but they were causing some alarm and despondency coming on our flank because we were swinging east towards Pakoku and they were coming up from the south. And so I was detached at Tilin. I think, yes, the whole battalion was detached. And I led the way down. And that was where we had a mess at Tilin, where I went down just after dawn, and to my amazement found there was a Canadian fighter pilot who'd been shot down over the Irrawaddy and had tried to walk home. And our troops had seen him in his flying helmet just at dawn and seen him stand up and look because he could hear the fighting and was trying to get nearer and nearer without running into the Japanese. And the troops saw him and very nearly bagged him because they put a bullet pretty close past him somewhere. And he immediately put his hands up and was brought in. And I said to this chap, Johnson his name was, he was a Canadian. And I said to him, well, how's it feel to be back? And he took one look at me and said, brother, you'll never know. And he went off back. Of course, I never saw him again. But he was obviously a chap who had a bit of courage because he'd stuck it out and got himself back into our lines. And I think we quickly chased the Jap off again. They started to withdraw. There were no serious battles at Tilin. And so we went back and were given the job of capturing Pakoku, which is quite near where the Chinwin and the Irrawaddy Join, on the bend of the Irrawaddy going up towards Mandalay. And we did have a pretty hard battle at Pococu, because I remember it well, as Alastair Ovens, the commander of D Company, was killed, unfortunately, and I was sent forward with C Company to carry on the capture. I was sent for by the colonel, and all that I recall that he said to me was, "Orders are, capture Pococu." And I had to go out where the other company had been stopped by the Japanese and pinned down out just on the edge of the village. And I had to take my company and push through and get right through to the bank of the Irrawaddy, which we did. It wasn't that desperate, because as usual, I think the Jap had had a bit of a pasting, and in the interim, after D Company had lost their commander, which rather destroyed their morale a bit, the Jap started to withdraw, and I went in as far as the bank of the river and set up my headquarters in a warehouse there. And I remember immediately we started getting shells over, which were hitting the houses round about. And a local came along, and he told me that there was a Japanese just on the other side, on the river bank. And I well remember we had a lovely shoot, because I got the mortars across, when I say it, not, I don't mean across the Irrawaddy, because that's a hell of a size there, but it was across the first branch of the Irrawaddy, which was only about 200 yards across. Those big rivers have all got channels and islands and so on, and they extend, and the main stream, of course, can be 2 or 3 miles across. But there was this OP officer, Japanese, firing the guns from farther over on the island in the Irrawaddy, shooting at my buildings, because he could see us milling about. And we got a jolly good shoot back with the mortars, 3-inch mortars from the battalion, and got an almost direct hit right on his trench, whereupon he left running as hard as he could go, and he was one of the ones that got away, because we didn't succeed in getting him. Yes, and then, of course, having captured Pococu and got to the banks of the Irrawaddy,